but how you present the argument, of course, is up to you. There's a toggle switch that you can use to raise and lower the podium if you see fit to do that. And also, I would note that we place the oral arguments on the internet, so if you have any private or confidential information, you may wish to be careful as to how you refer to that. And finally, I would ask that if anybody has a cell phone, to make sure that it's turned off or placed on vibrate so it doesn't inadvertently interrupt us during the oral argument. So with that having been said, we're ready to hear the oral argument in People v. Lopez.
May it please the court. My name is Brian DeBush. I represent Michael Lopez in this case. He is still incarcerated in prison for a term of 16 years on the top charge. But we brought this motion, and I'm sorry, I would like to reserve about 5 minutes for rebuttal if I could.
Okay, I'll try and remind you when you get to that point.
I'll watch the line.
Okay, good.
In this case, we filed a rather extensive motion under 35C to ask for and receive a hearing on what looked like shortcomings of trial counsel, mistakes in the trial itself, and issues that were not earlier raised in the appeal, the direct appeal, heard, I think, by and written about by Judge Tobin previously. In the motion for new trial, we tried to raise what looked like just mistakes of trial counsel, including failures to investigate witnesses, diagram scenes, look at the scene of the crime, or even just the vehicle and the door that was the subject of the entry of the bullet, to investigate any of those things, to look at an alternate suspect identified by my client's father, to look at the circumstances of the other witnesses that were involved in this case but never charged apparently with anything. There was one that was arrested on a warrant but released and the charges were dismissed. So out of what happened in this case, the only person convicted of anything was Michael Lopez. The court can see from the record in this case, it looked like initially they were identifying him as the principal, and that seems to be the theory they began with at trial. But by the end of the trial, what became the mutated theory was perhaps he was the complicitor, and what it comes down to is whether or not he was the passenger who was screaming at the other victim vehicle and shooting, or the driver, the one who was identified as having either transported or received some sort of object from another vehicle into the suspect vehicle. That seemed to be the primary issue. And what it came down to for the jury, at least what it looks like it came down to for the jury, was who was the principal, who did the shooting, and if this individual was not the principal, what did he intend, what did he know about before the shooting occurred? That looks to have been the primary issue in the case. What did Mr. Lopez know about?
Mr. DeBosch, isn't it true that the jury was instructed with regard to Mr. Lopez that he could be involved either as a principal or as a complicitor?
They were instructed that, yes, there was a complicity instruction in the record. Now, had trial counsel done a better job at preparing for the case, had trial counsel done a better job of investigating, that theory could have been nailed down either one or the other before the trial began, but it looked like trial counsel was completely surprised and taken by surprise, allowed Mr. Lopez to testify about his involvement in this case, and it doesn't look like trial counsel ever addressed the complicity theory, not at least in the arguments he made to the jury.
Josh, I didn't see a claim, though, that it was error or deficient performance to allow the defendant to testify.
No, I didn't make that claim.
All right. And he testified that he was at least the driver.
Yes, he did.
All right. And given all the evidence of complicity, what does it matter whether, I mean, it seems like all of what you're complaining about went to show that he wasn't the shooter. But there was all this evidence that even if he wasn't the shooter, he was a complicitor. So what does that get you?
Okay. Here's what it gains. I'm assuming what the jury, I don't know this, but I'm assuming what the jury came down to was that he was not the principal. That's what I'm assuming based on his own testimony, that he was the driver and not the person shooting the gun. The next thing the jury questioned was, what was the intent of Mr. Lopez when driving this vehicle? Now, there's only one piece of evidence. It was by the RTD driver. The RTD driver said, I saw the driver of that vehicle come out, go back to the SUV behind it, grab an item that he thought was a gun, transport it back to the vehicle in front.
Actually, he said it was Mr. Lopez who did it. He identified the defendant, didn't he?
Well, his indication was that the person in the photographic lineup that most resembled the person he saw driving was Mr. Lopez.
That's the person he saw retrieve what he thought was a gun.
At trial, that's what he said. Yes, okay. That's accurate. And the reason I brought up identity issues was because the individuals in the victim vehicle identified the shooter as potentially Mr. Lopez. They identified both of the individuals in the suspect cars looking roughly the same. At trial, things changed a little bit and identified Mr. Lopez, at least the daughter did, as both the driver and the shooter, meaning that the shot had to come from the driver's seat. All of these things play out, but only in one way that's really important to my client, and that is, what was his intent in driving that vehicle down the road that day, and did he know that his passenger, one, had a gun, two, was going to use the gun to commit what was an extreme indifference murder act that could be used against him later. The jury, at least four of them, after the trial was over, went back to the judge and indicated in a letter and indicated to the judge that they didn't think Mr. Lopez had intended to kill anyone. So what seems to have happened at the trial was, based on the jury question about intent and the four jurors who disagreed later with the jury verdict and had problems with their own votes on the panel, what seems to have happened was the jury was confused about what it meant to be a complicitor and what intent was required to be found guilty as a complicitor as to the extreme indifference murder.
That's not the issue before us now. The issue before us now is, was counsel ineffective in some way? And maybe you should address how counsel was ineffective in connection with the point you just made, because I'm not connecting up what you're saying. I understand you can make a direct appeal on that, but you've had that already. He's had that already. How is counsel ineffective?
Because counsel never did any investigation that can be found in the record anywhere, never endorsed any witness, never filed any motion to go through any of these issues before the trial began. So by the time the trial begins and we get to the point where the jury is asking questions about what is your client's intent, it looks like defense counsel hasn't presented any evidence or very little evidence on that point. And that becomes the main point for the jury. He could have anticipated that. He could have prepared. He could have looked at any of the other things going on with the other witnesses to get their statements, including just dispatch tapes of phone calls reporting these very crimes, but didn't do any of those things.
End up being what? To show that a lack of intent on the defendant would have taken him off the case, even as a complicitor? I mean, he got up there and testified. I was driving the car.
Yep.
I didn't know the guy had a gun. The jury disbelieved him. What? I'm not sure what the investigation you claim would have done. Once he got up there to testify, the jury had the right to disbelieve him, did they not? There was other testimony that he retrieved the gun from the SUV. There was testimony that he was a shooter. There was the testimony that he gang signs were being thrown. And there's a lot of testimony on that. The jury had the right to disbelieve it, to be sure, but they apparently did not. Notwithstanding the point you make about what happened after the verdict was delivered.
Okay, now let's get to that point about the four jurors who come forward later. I did make that part of the 35C motion. I wanted to make that part of the appeal, but put that point aside for just a second. What could trial counsel have done to recast his client as something other than a complicitor with the intent that his passenger commit extreme indifference murder or attempt to do so? That becomes the primary issue. He didn't present or didn't develop even a theory of defense that would defeat that. He seemed to be saying throughout the trial from opening to close, you can't prove that my client shot at this truck.
It seems that the trial lawyer was trying to do more than that, because Mr. Lopez, as Judge Richmond indicated, testified that he was the driver and he didn't know that the passenger had a gun. I mean, that would seem like it was testimony that was intended to refute any complicity theory. Would you agree?
Two things. The first is whether or not he knew his passenger had a gun. once the gun is out and he knows it's there, does he know, sorry, not know, does he intend that his passenger then shoot at and commit an attempted extreme indifference murder against this other vehicle? I mean, that's what has to be shown.
Testified that he didn't, but apparently the jury didn't believe him. So I'm not sure what the counsel could do. I mean, he can only do so much. Take the specifics you say. He could have investigated the criminal history of some of the witnesses. Right. First of all, what would that have shown? It's not clear from your brief what it would have shown as to any one of these witnesses. And secondly, would it be admissible? I mean, if there was an arrest warrant out for one, that probably would not be admissible, would it?
Okay, let me talk about that. The testimony of Mr. Lopez at trial was that while he was driving down the street and this other vehicle was in this altercation with him and his passenger is screaming at the other vehicle, he says, I see the passenger in the other vehicle pick up something in his hand, point it towards us, and is still yelling now at the passenger. So,
self-defense, a defense offered?
Not self-defense as a defense, but that goes to whether or not his intent is that his passenger commit an attempted extreme indifference murder against this other vehicle. That's what it becomes. It's not self-defense. It wouldn't be. But what is Mr. Lopez's intent? If he's the driver and doesn't have the gun in his hand, and that's what the jury comes down on, if that's what they believe, that he was the complicit in the driver's seat, what does he intend?
So how would the criminal record of this person who you claim is in the other vehicle flashing on be relevant to that?
And that's one of the problems with trial counsel, is he didn't ask Spencer Cheeks what his prior record was or if he had ever been involved in any violent acts or anything that would lead to those types of questions. He didn't ask Mr. Cheeks if he didn't brandish anything out the window. And that becomes a real problem for Mr. Lopez when Mr. Lopez gets up there and testifies that he sees these things and Mr. Cheeks hasn't been examined on any of those issues. Now, Mr. Cheeks may have gotten up and said, yeah, you know, I had a cell phone in my hand, I was calling the police, and I was waving it at the other vehicle. That could be.
But how does Mr. Cheeks' criminal history become relevant unless the defendant knew about it? I mean, you're talking about the defendant's state of mind, whether he had the intent, what was his intent. So if he thinks the driver in the other car intends to do something, I guess I don't understand how his criminal history relates to that unless defendant knew about it.
Yeah, there's a couple separate steps in order to make it ultimately admissible. But what I'm saying is if trial counsel had investigated, didn't ask any questions of Mr. Cheeks about that incident to corroborate his own client's story, and Mr. Cheeks gets off the stand without ever answering any of those questions, if he had done a proper job and knew that Mr. Cheeks had both a domestic violence conviction shortly before and a concealed weapons conviction quite a ways before this trial, he could have cross-examined Mr. Cheeks, and Mr. Cheeks could not have denied that he had a previous, what was a violent history.
So it might have affected his credibility. Is that
it
what
might
you're
have
saying?
Affected Mr. Cheeks' credibility, yeah. But it would have corroborated Mr. Lopez's story. If those things had happened, if those things had gone on, if that investigation had occurred and Mr. Cabral got up and asked those questions of the witness during the trial, but didn't, unfortunately.
I guess I'm confused as to how it corroborates the defendant's story. Again, unless the defendant knows about these prior acts, how does it affect his state of mind?
I'm not saying it's a 405 issue. I'm not saying it's something related to his knowledge of a propensity of the other party. What I'm saying is during cross-examination of that witness, when he's up there at trial, and Mr. Cheeks is saying, you know, we were just driving down the street and these things happened and we didn't do it. To not ask Mr. Cheeks any questions to corroborate Mr. Lopez's story harmed Mr. Lopez's case because you're bypassing all the information that would help out his testimony later. You can get Mr. Cheeks to admit, yes, I was yelling, yes, I was cursing, yes, I had something in my hand. And if he denies having something in his hand and indicates that he's just a very peaceful person with his family and he doesn't do those kinds of things, you know, the domestic violence conviction he had was just shortly before the trial itself.
Sir Cheeks testify that he was a peaceful person and he wasn't waving a gun?
No, he wasn't even asked any of the questions that would make those things relevant.
All right.
So trial counsel didn't go far enough in investigating the case and being prepared to cross-examine the witnesses.
Also talk about his failure to submit an alternate suspect theory, or alternative suspect theory, whichever is the terminology. I don't understand how that's prejudicial to Mr. Lopez, given the fact that he got there and testified as to his own theory of defense that had nothing to do with an alternative suspect. I mean, did have an alternative suspect, but again, was disbelieved.
Yeah, there were a number of other people involved in this. So in terms of a suspect, what I'm talking about is the Anthony Montoya identified by the father and talked to by the father both before and after the trial.
But also mentioned by the defendant in his testimony at the trial, right? He's the guy that was supposedly in the car, Anthony in the car, who did the shooting, right?
Yes.
So it came into evidence, and again, it appears that the jury did not accept it, did not believe him. So I don't see where counsel fell short there.
I don't think it's accurate to say that the jury just didn't believe that there was another individual in the vehicle that did these things. I think they may have.
But they still found him liable as a complicitor then.
Right. In terms of identifying that individual, the district attorney was allowed to cross-examine then Mr. Lopez after he testified. Why didn't you come forward with this information? Why didn't you identify this person by height, weight, hair color, and general appearance? Why didn't you give us this information before trial? It was what was implied. And because Mr. Cabral held on to that information, she was allowed to ask all of those questions as a means of impeaching Mr. Lopez. That's one of the responses I'd give. The other response I'd give is if you knew who this alternate suspect was and you identified them before trial and said, this is the person that committed and is the principal and I am not the complicitor, it would have helped to corroborate Mr. Lopez's story if he had done that. If he had explored that alternate suspect theory and endorsed that alternate suspect either before trial or during, it would have made it much, much, much simpler. Mr. Lopez could have come across as looking more credible. I see him out of time.
Thank you, Mr. DeBosch. I appreciate your argument.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Paul Kaler. I'm an first assistant attorney general at the Department of Law. As the court knows, there are two grounds on which defendant must demonstrate to show that his counsel was ineffective. First of all, that counsel's performance was extremely substandard. And secondly, that substandard performance actually had an effect on the jury's verdict. I think the problem with all the defendant's allegations, which I believe are all, except for one, are all vague and conclusory in his post-conviction motion, have to do with he hoped that something would have occurred had trial counsel conducted his defense differently. But a unilateral hope by the defendant that something else would have happened is not sufficient. The defendant actually has to show evidence that would have changed the result of trial. He just hopes that what would happen, that things would have turned out differently. And there is really no legal distinction between a complicitor and principal under Colorado law. If the defendant acts with the same intent as a shooter, he is guilty under Colorado law. That was the defendant's defense at trial. That was the defense that the jury did not believe. And the only evidence really that could support that was the defendant's own testimony that I did not know what my passenger was going to do. And that was presented. And so people do not see how the result of the trial could have been different at all had alternate suspects been accused, especially the one that was already accused at trial. There's just nothing that's set forth in the defendant's post-conviction motion that would have warranted holding a hearing on the defendant's allegations.
About that point that he just made about, I think what he meant was timing of the disclosure of the alternate suspect, although that's not what the brief exactly said, but the way he just explained it, had the alternate suspect been disclosed, I guess, pre-trial, it would have changed the way that the cross-examination would have gone at the defendant and perhaps made him more credible. Does that fall below the standard? Is it prejudicial?
I don't know, because the defendant's first story was he was alone in the car when he was talking to the case detective. At trial, he said this other person was there, and that was, if anybody was going to testify that there was another person that was there, it was the defendant. He knew that was his testimony. It could have been a surprise to the defense if the defendant had been talking to his counsel.
It could not have been a surprise to the defense if he knew that before the trial.
Right.
Right. And if he inadequately questioned his own client before the trial, and we don't know this because there wasn't a hearing on the Rule 35C, and I think that's really what he's complaining about. He wants to have a hearing on his Rule 35C. Do we need to go back and find out whether there were reasons why counsel didn't do what he did, or can we tell from the record that it's non-prejudicial? Or not below the standard of care.
Well, it was just vague and conclusory at the time, so there's no reason to do anything further on the motion. But the defendant has to allege that he somehow had not told his counsel one thing. He had to have been changing his stories, because his police statement to the detective was he was there by himself. And in order for him to have some sort of hope that of a hearing, I believe he would have had to have made allegations that he told his counsel that was not true, and that if he were to testify, he would identify somebody named Tony as the person that was there and did that. But if the defendant had not told his counsel at the time of trial or beforehand during preparation that his statement to the police was untrue, then the defendant is actually, that's the defendant's fault, and he's stuck with it. It's not the fault of counsel that the defendant told untrue or told a story to the case detective that he did not tell at trial.
Such allegation in the Rule 35C.
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Is there affidavits for the Rule 35C?
I don't believe there were. I think all the post-conviction motion shows is a unilateral hope that something would come up during a hearing that could possibly be used to support an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, but that's not sufficient under our rules. The defendant has to allege facts, verifiable facts, and I think the only fact that was alleged was that the auto body shop owner had a warrant for sexual assault, a pending warrant. But our argument on that is that he was an entirely uncontroversial witness, and even if that was admissible, it would not have, there was nothing to impeach in his testimony. He was the one that testified that Marla Martinez, who was probably the driver of the SUV or the passenger of the SUV, had dropped off the defendant's car to have the bumper repaired. He knew nothing about the defendant at all, and in no way tied the defendant to the crime. He was entirely uncontroversial, we believe. But the trial court, we believe, properly summarily denied this post-conviction motion because the defendant failed to allege facts showing that holding a hearing would have been useful. That's all I have to say. If the court has any further questions, I'd like to try and address them.
I don't think so. Thank you, Mr. Keller. We appreciate your argument.
You.
Mr. DeBosch, again, thank you. We appreciate your argument as well. I don't think so. Your time is up, but thank you again both for your argument. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.